Hey all, and welcome to the Book Spider Podcast, the podcast in which three old friends take you along through the dark mercurial mysteries of the written word, often lost, sometimes political, always opinionated. Today we're talking about Mark Danielewski's House of Leaves, published in 2000. House of Leaves is a pretty famous literary puzzle that has the distinction of being both popular and pretty challenging. It's often compared to Gravity's Rainbow, Infinite Jest, and Moby Dick for its overtly shaggy, fragmented, footnote-filled structure. Several different narrators and editors and curated voices handling the same material at different stages en route to publication step in and out of the telling of the novel. The book uses different fonts and colors to help the reader distinguish between these different voices. We have the core narrative called The Navidson Record, a book-length analysis of a documentary by the same name by one of our two primary narrators. His name is Zampano. I don't know how to pronounce that with the little thing over the O. Zampano. His name is Zampano. This section is in Black Times New Roman for the most part, until sections start to appear in crossed out red text. These red sections, crossed out because Zampano tried to destroy them, tie the events of the documentary to the myth of the Minotaur and the Labyrinth. And I'm reading this, what I wrote for the intro, and it occurs to me that even this is not the primary text. The actual documentary is perhaps, you know, in some ways the primary text, but we're not even sure that the documentary ever existed. The other core narrative calls that into question. This other core narrative is presented to us by other primary narrator, Johnny Truant, a young man who seems to have been psychically poisoned by the process of putting Zampano's Navidson record together, even as he acknowledges that it's almost entirely fabricated, that is, Zampano's text. His increasingly desperate notes are in Courier. There are editor's notes, too, that sometimes puzzle over Truant's stranger entries, or sometimes gather responses from some of the many women Truant seeks help from and or hooks up with in the process of putting this text together. The editor's entries are in Bookman, and there are letters from Truant's institutionalized mother gathered in one of several appendices at the book's end. There are countless other flourishes. You have to turn the book upside down at points or hold the book up to a mirror, and so on. The point is, we're reminded throughout how many hands this text has passed through to put it together, and we're told even that the core events never happened, and our ability to read the book is constantly challenged. So, the reality of what we're reading is constantly pretty fucking hard to put together. Before having this conversation with y'all, I kind of have an hypothesis. I think I will have had more fun reading this than I will talking about it. Not because I suspect either of you is going to shit on this novel necessarily, though maybe you will. I just think that this book's vibes are a little bit stronger than its ideas. Maybe I'm completely wrong about that. Maybe also it's a symptom of only having read this once. I can see maybe the ideas coming into a little bit better focus reading it several times. I believe, Hans, you've read this several times. But even though it's using those ideas to generate the vibes, and the vibes we have here are horror house vibes. This is a very, uncanny. We even have a big explication of the word uncanny, unheimlich, German, in the novel. We have, pretty creepy shit going on, throughout the novel. And at times I found it pretty unsettling in a way that I very much enjoyed. But I always felt, kind of looking back through the novel, the pieces didn't come together in any really strong thematic way for me. So maybe this is an opportunity for you guys to argue, that there were strong themes. Rather, the presentation of those ideas felt very strong in the moment of reading, as something that was just experientially pretty powerful. So with that in mind, what ideas or themes did you get from this novel, and how did you feel about them?
Well, I've heard it described as a satire of academia,
And the core text, the Navidson record, is ostensibly, even though it describes the events of the film in such depth that it kind of becomes like a novelization of the film, essentially, it also contains a great amount of citation and quotation of academic analysis of the film. And I don't know for sure. I don't know for sure what it's saying about academic analysis or about that way of thinking and judging and knowing. I guess the question would come down to, you know, whether the academics who are being quoted are actually shedding light on meaning or just kind of jerking themselves off, right? And I think I might have to go through it again just trying to focus on that question, but I mean, I think there are some places where it's the one and some places where it's the other, right? Like there's a certain amount of the quotes are just kind of are like smug, self-satisfied vapidity. But there are places, I think, too, where some of the underlying questions are teased by the commentators in interesting ways, right? I'm thinking particularly of the moment when Navidson decides to return to the house and re-explore it after the traumatic fourth exploration, right? And there are like several different commentators, because there's no internality to these characters because of the nature of the structure of the text. It's a totally whatever the opposite of omniscient is, right? Like there's no internality to the characters. Which is an interesting obstacle, right? And one way that Daniel Lewski gets around that obstacle as a writer is to have these external commentators speculating on the motivations and the mindsets of the characters. And there are several different analyses of why Navidson might have gone back in the house, and those kind of substitute for real internality, right? And I thought that was a very interesting technique, and also that those commentators seem to shed real light on the meaning, or not, they seem to shed real light on what the motivations might be or what it might mean for him to do that, to the extent that that's knowable. So I don't know if it's a critique of academia. I don't know if it's a satire of it. It seems like it's existing in relationship to ideas about academic criticism, but I don't know for sure if it doesn't neatly come out pro or anti or mocking or you know, glorifying, that I was able to find it.
Example of that would be in analyzing Karen's promiscuity. There's Karen, Navidson's wife, has an affair, or two affairs, I believe, in the novel, and or one affair, and then kisses Jed, or no, Wax, kisses Wax and makes out with Wax. And there are hints to earlier affairs and problems in her marriage, but then it does feel like the text sort of calls that analysis into question, because it actually like says that, you know, these are vectors for analyzing Karen's character that kind of emerge from sexism. And so it's kind of like trying to investigate her motivations and develop internality, but also to examine the actual examination of her. So it's kind of having it both ways. But Patrick, you were going to say something too.
Well, I was actually just going to say the exact same thing that Hans said. I didn't have a lot of strong feelings about what I thought the novel was doing until I, you know, looked up some things that people had said, and one of them that it was a satire of academia. But also Hans said that, like, at some points the academic writing seems like cogent and interesting, and at others it seems vapid. So, like, you know, I still maintain after all these years that if you're gonna do satire effectively, Like, if it's going to be effective as satire, you need to lean hard in one direction or another. And, you know, so, like, if you have vapidity next to something interesting, then the satire is not going to work very much. So I'm not convinced that it's satirizing academia, but that was something that maybe I had thought.
I suppose you could also read it as a novel about trauma, but I don't know that it necessarily has anything meaningful to say about trauma. Like, trauma is, like, present. In some sense, the whole thing is essentially an extended reaction to trauma. But I don't know that and maybe if, like, I were an orphan and my parents had both died horribly, maybe I would have, like, an emotional relationship to it somehow. But I don't know that it had anything meaningful to say about the nature of trauma or the experience of trauma or healing from trauma, right? I mean, that's very present as a plot device, but not necessarily that I was able to find cogently elaborated on as a theme.
This is definitely one of those really ambiguous novels that I have trouble with, and, like, Hans, it seems like you would like.
Well, I don't know if I'm not sure that it's that ambiguous, actually, right? I mean, it's ambiguous in the sense that it doesn't...
You always say that. I always say it's ambiguous. You're like,
well,
okay. I don't know.
But maybe
you're right. Maybe you're right.
I have a difficult relationship to this novel because I think it's pretty good in certain ways and has notable flaws and can be fairly annoying. But it is so, maybe more so than any novel I've ever read, it insists on itself as a masterpiece so much, you know? It is so, like, it insists on its own power in ways that I find very annoying. So it's like it doesn't want to be a B-minus novel, and it kind of, like, goes so far out of its way to announce itself as an A-plus novel, while in fact being a B-minus novel. So it's hard for me to talk about it or think about it without wanting to tear it down, because it's like, it just is very arrogant. It's a very arrogant novel, you know? Or it seems to me like a very arrogant novel.
Let's talk about the, because I think I'm in very much the same place. I really liked parts of this novel. What are the parts that, you know, you like? And you know, Patrick, I don't know if there's parts that you liked.
I really like the main story of the like academic critical discussion of the documentary, the Navidson record. For some reason in my head, I kept calling it the Navidson record, even though it's Navidson is probably better. I really liked the formal experiments, except that, like, it became excessive and, like, really fucked with my head, basically. You know, like, I'm trying to get into the story of like, this messed up house with a room that's too big on the inside. And then, you know, Johnny Truant comes in with another story about quaaludes and fucking women, you know.
he fucks so many women.
Yeah, which... You know, that to me read a little bit too much like some kind of weird not prepubescent, but like teenage boys fantasy, you know, where, yeah, that, you know, all teenage boys want to be, you know, ladies' men.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, I feel exactly the same way, right? Like the core, right. The kind of core text I thought was very enjoyable.
Right, exactly.
And I liked the idea of it. I liked the form of it. I liked I thought the characters were compelling, you know, like that thing in the middle of it is great, actually.
Right, exactly.
And all the shit around it, I do think that if you had a novel that was just that core thing, it might feel... like it was missing something, you know? Like,
right.
I do understand the need to kind of have elaborations or frames around that. I just think that the you know, like a lot of the stuff that was added around it, it's like the novel. This is going to sound a little bit like a prepackaged spiel because I was thinking about this yesterday, right? Like, let me see if I can get through this thought. So the title, House of Leaves. The leaves in the title, I assume, are pages, right? Like, the book is a house of leaves, meaning that in some sense, the book is, in a way, the house in the film, right?
Mm.
And so the book is the house in the film. And the, like, symbolically, right, metaphorically, or maybe even in a little bit of a literal way, because, like, Johnny, I believe, we're meant to understand that Johnny is in some way creating the film, right? Like, Johnny is Johnny is actually writing the Davidson record somehow, right?
Yeah.
So, like, the book is... The book is something that Johnny is creating in relationship to his trauma, his history of trauma. So I was going somewhere with that and I lost it. But like, am I right in thinking those things on some level that like Johnny is creating the book? The book is because the Institute is in Virginia, right? Like the house is in Virginia, the Institute is in Virginia. The kind of the there are like little signs, you know, there's like a moment when Daisy, the daughter, gets like cuts down her arm in the same place that Johnny has the cuts on his arm or the scars on his arm from the hot water. There's a couple other little things like that. I don't quite remember. There are a couple weird little typos where he like the narrative suddenly lapses into first person in the Davidson record.
Yeah. And Truett says at one point that he's directly editing what he found from Zampano, and you know whether or not Zampano exists or this sort of seed crystal like text exists, like you know if you assume that it does exist, Truant is saying that he is altering it, like so like he's participating in the creation of this core narrative to some extent.
And there's even like I don't know how definitive this is, right? But like I think that you guys both have a physical copy of this, right? It's not on like Kindle or audiobook. So like, if you just open there's like the black cover and then there's a collage right underneath that, right? And there's text in the collage. Perhaps I will alter the whole thing, kill both children. Murder is a better word. Chad scrambling to escape. There's like him kind of, you know, thinking about changing the plot. I don't know if that's a question of like altering the text or if that's a question of like revising it as an author, right? Altering it as an editor or revising it as an author. Oh, but I remember what I was going to say. So I remember where I was going with this, right? Like the book is a house of leaves, meaning that the book is the house. And then the house is a labyrinth, which means the book needs to be a labyrinth, right? Structurally, the book needs to be a labyrinth to kind of have form recapitulating content and theme, right? Which would be very satisfying, except that I think a lot of what's being done to make the book labyrinthine ends up making it cluttered. And that's maybe like maybe failure is too strong a word because the book was very popular and successful and people love it, right? The fuck do I know? But like, that's kind of, to me, the grand failure of the scheme is that to really tie the whole thing together into this conceptual bow, the book needs to be a labyrinth, but the labyrinthine nature of it actually ends up, I think, undermining. It's not really labyrinthine. It's just crammed with shit. And that,
yeah,
right. Yeah,
so
yeah.
It, you know, like it gets 80% of the way there, but then it tries so hard in the final 20% to like kind of achieve a masterpiece sort of level of neatness in how everything conceptually lines up. And then it sort of makes it adds this like scrim of annoyingness over what's actually pretty effective at its core.
Yeah, and This is your third time through it, Hans. Yeah, this is my first, and I'm a little more. I think that I was trying to draw this line. I think you helped me, where I felt, you know, when I was probably around when Tom Davidson's brother is killed. There's a kind of a natural sort of climactic or nadir there, where, like, you know, this is like, this is the awfulness that, you know, propels Davidson into the house the fifth time, and before we get to kind of a reconciliation ending between him and Karen. But, like, there was this feeling around that point in the novel for me, like, simultaneously, like, I was having a good time and I actually enjoyed the puzzle box elements of the book, but I remembered feeling like sort of like a room full of people with names, like I didn't remember any of their names and I didn't really care that I didn't. So, like, there was something about the experience of the puzzle boxy nature of it being fun and compelling, but also, but intellectually maybe not carrying the calories that I would want for something that is so full of ideas. Like, the ideas seem to be carrying something for the experience of reading it more than for, like, the intellectual explication after you've read it or talking about it. And that's something that I felt the first time through, and I can see how reading it the second time through, I'm almost primed to find all that shit really annoying. Like, instead of actually kind of fun, you know, like, I kind of liked sort of like moving, you know, back and forth, you know, trying to figure out, like, which foot, you know, what this footnote was talking about, you know, and sort of connecting things, you know, up in the novel. I liked that. That was fun. I don't think I'm going to like it as much the second time. And I don't know that the second time through, that type of searching is going to bring me to any sort of deeper understanding of some of the themes of the novel. And that's where I think the frustration comes in. So,
well, and when I said it was ambiguous earlier, I'm not necessarily sure that, I don't know, like, what are the ambiguities, right? Like, what are we coming out the other end unsure of? It's not, I think, like, it's pretty clear what happens, like, the narrative action of both the Davidson record and the Johnny Truant layer, I think, is relatively clear, or as clear as you would want it to be. I guess it's kind of ambiguous how Johnny Truant ends up, but I don't know that I care, or that there's, like, compelling things to be ambiguating between. And I don't think I don't get the sense that it's, like, saying, is there, like, some kind of, like, deeper meaning about the nature of XYZ that we could puzzle out with multiple readings? I don't really think so. What were you going to say, Patrick?
Well, I guess that's what I mean when I say it's ambiguous, because I agree, like, you know, there's a lot of stuff, and it is kind of a jumble to read, like, it like, with the footnotes and the structure, it can be tangled and not always totally easy to like, you know, I found myself like, man, rather than like dropping down to the read another footnote of Truant, you know, on some bender, it's like, I'd really rather just go on with the story of the documentary. But what I mean is that it is ambiguous thematically. You know, we've already said we were not sure, like, what it means. Like, we've said, well, it could be a satire of academia. It could be, you know, and you said, Hans, it could be that it is the form of the novel being a house of leaves, you know, like a some kind of fictional structure within a fictional structure within a fictional structure, you know, maybe that points to something, some statement about the world or some statement about the nature of life or the nature of the human condition or the nature of reality or whatever, but we don't know what that is. So I would say ambiguity on that front, but go on.
I don't think it's ambiguous. I think it's just empty, right?
Okay.
I just don't think that they're saying any of those things. Right. It's like, I don't know. Like, I'm trying to think of something that is thematically ambiguous. You know, like, I don't know, like Underworld by Don DeLillo, right? Like, it's saying things about the nature of memory and history that in some places might seem like they contradict themselves, or it might be a little hard to kind of tangle out which parts are relevant to the theme. But you know that there are ideas about memory and history that are being explored and tossed around, and maybe the statements being made are... It's ambiguous exactly what you can't take the ideas about memory and history in that book and condense them into a neat essay, right? As opposed to, let's say, Things Fall Apart by Chinua Achebe, right? You can take the themes and condense them into a one-page essay. That's not a thematic.
Right.
Underworld, thematically ambiguous. House of Leaves, thematically empty.
Yeah, and kind of a more specific, because I think that's what, you know, how this book suffers being compared, and it wants to be compared. That's the kind of annoying thing about it, is like, it wants to be compared to these, you know, sort of huge, thematically rich novels that are very rightfully famous and adored. And just to go to a more specific ambiguous example, the Moby Dick, The White Whale, right? So like, The White Whale. It's a specific thing. It's a specific
Mastodon.
Yeah. It's a specific entity. It's a locus of meaning, you know, and, you know, for all the time that you spend circling it in Moby Dick, it, you know, it's not ambiguous what the white whale is, but it's incredibly rich and ambiguous in what it means.
Right.
Is it doom? Is it fate?
It's probably doom, fate, all kinds of things.
Is it, you know, is it ambition? Is it, you know, what is it?
It's Pip getting hypnotized by the endlessness of the sea.
Yeah. So like I'm right with you, Hans. I feel like that's the thing that, you know, is annoying about this book, because it really wants to be. Danielewski wants this to be read in a class of those types of novels. And
I did read it in a class of those types of novels.
Oh, you did?
As an undergrad, yeah. I read this in a class with Gravity's Rainbow, Crash by Ballard, and If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler by Italo Calvino. Maybe a couple other things, too, that I'm forgetting, but those are the four that stuck with me. And, you know, at the time, as an undergrad, I enjoyed this by far the most out of those texts. And then in the 15 years, 20 years since then, my appreciation of those other works has grown and grown, except If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler, which I'm actually not that fond of, but like, Crash, Gravity's Rainbow,
understandable.
Like, as you guys know, like, those are, you know, some of my favorite pieces of art in any medium ever. And this has not, obviously has not aged for me in that same way. You mentioned the white whale in Moby Dick, right? The obvious rejoinder.
The
I guess,
white
is like,
whale. Sorry.
And you mentioned that.
I had to do it again.
It's funny because like this, you know, like there's the white whale in Moby Dick. And that's the big thematically ambiguous statement. The big thematically ambiguous object, right? And I guess I can imagine somebody who's a fan of this book being like, no, there's the house with the infinite rooms. That's a big thematically rich object. But it's like, oh, that's just trauma. That's family trauma, right? That's what it symbolizes. I don't know. Maybe it's unkind of me to collapse it that simply. But I guess in a way it is like one of my least favorite kind of trends in cinema in the last decade has been horror movies where the monster is trauma, right?
Babadook, yeah.
Babadook, Men, give me 10 minutes and I could make a much longer list, right? And it's not like that doesn't work as a motif or an idea. It's that when all you have is the monster is trauma, right? When all, when your whole, all the symbolism and thematics of your movie can be reduced neatly to the monster is trauma in ways that kind of collapse much more interesting or rich explication, or to some extent just make it less fun, right? That is frustrating.
It's so. My one of my questions was, do you have an interpretation about what this book is about? I don't need to ask that, I think, at this point. But the reason that I asked that is that I was kind of reading around about what, you know, interpretations are out there. And one of the popular sort of like strange ones is that the entire book is actually Johnny Truant's mother recovering, basically navigating madness, being institutionalized, and that like there are hints dropped throughout that that make that clear, or maybe imply that, or people read them that way. And I don't really like, I'd have to revisit it to even know if I agree with that reading. But the thing about it is that that just basically reframes the same problem with a different lens, where it's like, this is trauma, you know, and it's being told through this other, you know, person's perspective. And then all the layers within that are fabricated, and the largeness of it on the inside and the darkness of it on the inside is just basically reflective of trauma belonging to this other person. So in a way, even though that's clever, you know, maybe that's true, maybe that's not, it doesn't actually do anything about what you're saying, Hans, which is like adding to like the complexity, the multidimensionality, the hypercontextuality that you would want in a book like this, you know, thematically. And so I think that that's very interesting. I there's a lot of interpretations of this book, by the way, like what is actually going on. And that to me is, that's great. That's really fun that people are doing that. You know, that's a really interesting, you know, I'm glad that there are communities of people who are debating that. But I don't know that it does anything. It prolongs, I think, the thing that is enjoyable about this novel, which is just basically letting it kind of carry you like line by line in down interesting paths. And then, but looking back over those paths after you've traversed them, you know, it's not actually taking you down very profound lines of inquiry, I guess.
Debating what is actually happening, I think, is a very different thing from debating what it actually means. And
yes,
there might be space.
Yes.
There might be space to debate what is actually happening. But yeah, I agree with you that I don't know how I feel about the idea that Pelafina wrote the whole thing, right? I'm not that keen on that interpretation, but
yeah, I only put that out there as like, as kind of a, I don't know, just a strange, I mean, I don't either, but there are several people who are convinced of it, and you know, whatever.
And it might be, I don't know, like it might be that if Mark Danielewski, you know, listens to this and sends us an email saying, yeah, dumbass, of course Pelafina wrote the whole thing, like I don't think that would change my opinion about the book, or I don't know. Like I, in his Wikipedia, there's a few, and this is going to be maybe like needlessly mean, I don't know. Like I hope nobody listens, because I feel like anybody who might encounter this, who isn't just a regular listener of the podcast, is probably going to really love this book.
Yeah, it's true. So, they're going to say, oh my God, someone's released a podcast episode on House of Leaves. Like, I'm going to definitely listen to that. And they're going to be very upset, which
but,
they shouldn't be. This is a very enjoyable novel. I like it.
It's a very enjoyable novel. And it is fun to talk about, right? In the sense that it's always fun if you perceive a thing as overrated, and you have the ability to articulately explain how it's overrated and take it down the peg that it deserves, that's like the most fun thing to do, right? And I think this novel like just kind of like overrates itself, you know? So it's very hard to not have that relationship to it. I did mostly enjoy reading it all three times that I read it. And I think if you unlike many flawed books, I can imagine as an editor how I could make it notably better, right? I still don't think it would be that thematically rich, but you could pretty easily make it much more readable and rereadable, you know? But I do think this
what
is the mean
do?
Thing. Like, just take out a lot of the clutter, right? Stuff like the, like there's a chapter where there are like quote unquote cigarette burns where there are just random letters missing in brackets. Just get rid of that shit. Take the Johnny Truant stuff, remove it from being a footnote and just put it as interstitials between chapters. Take out the part where there's like, you know, there's like a part where there's like just a list of 1,000 different things that might appear in a house. Get rid of that kind of crap. Simplify the structure. Give up the idea that the book needs to formally be a labyrinth because that ends up just being a drag on its readability.
Right. Sure.
I don't know. I mean, maybe that would be, you could counter argue, I guess, that like there's a certain kind of youthful exuberance in, there's a certain kind of youthful exuberance and kind of manic quality in the way the whole thing is put together, and that the excesses of it are maybe kind of built into the foundation in some way. And there are many imperfect works of art that I would be comfortable agreeing with that about, but this isn't actually one of them. The mean thing I was going to say, though, is that I did read the Wikipedia for Mark Danielewski. I did read the Wikipedia for Mark Danielewski, and anytime it cites his interviews with him or his writings or anywhere that he's ostensibly writing as Mark Danielewski, his voice as a writer is an awful lot like Johnny Truant's, actually.
Mm.
Which kind of made me like him less as a writer. I really enjoyed this, and I have no desire to ever read anything else he's done, particularly from what I've read about the other things that he's done.
I really, really, really like the probably the most happy I felt was one of the explorations when they find the spiral staircase and they're going down, and it's very kind of Lovecraftian, strange, unsettling, you know, like, and it feels, I think that sensation of kind of like bottomlessness and like, you know, tipping down into something really deep and very compelling. And for that, that's a really great trick. And like a really, I thought that was very aesthetically satisfying and interesting. And it's really, there's potentially a lot of promise in saying in positioning that in that space as something that can't be explicated, that can't be understood. And then like that, what, you know, I think smartly like reflects back on the people, right? The characters who are inhabiting it. And there's some interesting things there, but it's almost too invested in that space being understandable and just orbiting that. And orbiting that. And I think that that's where, you know, a third of the way through the novel, I thought, this is really cool. And then, you know, two thirds of the way through the novel, I really recognized simultaneously that I was having a good time and that I probably wouldn't read it again. Patrick, you had a good time, but you found it frustrating.
No, I wouldn't say I had a good time. I would say that I found, like, I really like formalistic experiments like this. That was something that, like, you know, starting the novel, I was like, yeah, this is neat. Like, it's a fictional, so one guy has found another guy's manuscript and added to it, and that manuscript is referencing a documentary. So, like, there's the Russian doll effect of a thing nested within another thing nested within another thing that is pretty cool. Like, I like that formalistically. I like the academic stuff. That's actually, like, you know, I'm kind of trying to do something, writing a novel right now that is like an academic memoir of a philosophy professor turned serial killer. So I think these formalistic experiments are interesting. I would lean towards Hans's view that like it gets too jumbled. It's too full of stuff that's unnecessary. I would like it if the academic stuff felt better. So like we've mentioned before the pale fire problem, where if you create a work of fiction that has another work of another kind in it, that work has to be good at what it's doing. And like, I'm not sure that Zampano's like critical explication of this film is that great. I like the description of the film and like the tenseness and the horror and the terror, but I'm not sure I think that the critical acumen is there. Like we said earlier, it should be saying something about film or documentary or something like that, but it doesn't feel like it is. So there were a lot of things that I liked, but ultimately it was a little frustrating. And yes, I do tend to dislike fiction that, you know, does that postmodern trope thing where it's like, we're not sure what's real, we don't know what's happening, yada yada, it's a thing within a, you know, like, is this made up, is this happening, is it real? And like some novels that do that, The Garden of Seven Twilights, for example, have other things going for it that make me really enjoy the novel despite the essential, you know, postmodern skepticism about truth or whatever. But this novel didn't quite get there for me, even though like it seemed like it had a lot of promise.
Yeah, The Garden of Seven Twilights is a good poll. That, I'm definitely going to reread The Garden of Seven Twilights. I want to, in a way that I don't want to reread this
right,
one,
right,
even
right.
If I enjoyed reading.
Yeah,
reading
I would.
This one
I would
more than you.
I'm not sure that I have the emotional capacity to reread it right now, but I think it's definitely on my list to be reread, The Garden of Seven Twilights.
It's interesting to me that we haven't talked at all about the use of typography in the narrative sections. Because that's kind of one of his, it's like his signature trick as a writer across multiple books, from what I could tell on the Wikipedia. And it's like an entry on his Wikipedia that he does that. And it is something that I remembered quite vividly, having read it in undergrad. You know, when I thought about it afterward, I thought about that. And it's interesting that it's not, I guess maybe there's not that much to actually say about it. You know, like it's pretty clear. I think it's pretty clear what it's doing and why, you know. It is a very distinct, and if you were to describe the effect to me, I would think, oh, that sounds stupid. I don't want to read a book that does that. But it actually, I think, works pretty well.
Is it, Hans, do you think it's doing something other than making the distinct different storylines readable? Like for...
I think that what it's doing to some extent is, like, if you imagine those sections where like dramatic things are happening in the house as described in the account of the film, right? If you imagine those sections set in standard typography, because A, we have no access to the character's interiority, and B, there's essentially nothing to describe because they're just in a void for the really. If you set those in standard type, it would be very hard for them to, as a question of pacing, you would just get through it so quickly that it would be hard for it to build drama, right?
Sure,
what the typographical experiments are doing essentially is slowing down the act of reading in climactic moments in ways which extend suspense in ways that you couldn't if you just said it normally, because there's no internality and there's nothing to describe.
Okay, that makes sense.
It might be that Danielewski would say it's doing other things, right? But to my own sense as a reader, like, that is why it is beneficial. That's why it's important and helpful from a craft standpoint.
Well, on that note, thank you guys. House of Leaves, Mark Z. Danielewski. Enjoyable, maybe not one of the great American novels.
B minus, like Hans said.
Yeah. B minus.
C plus.
So what are we reading next?
D plus.
D plus. What are we reading next?
So the book that we're reading next, I have not read. It might suck. I will give you that warning. But I'll tell you why I was interested in it. There's a couple of reasons that I was interested in it. One of those is and maybe I'll go into more depth about these in the actual podcast episode, but you know, like, I of course, am a former aspiring novelist, right? And I haven't written a word of fiction in about 11 years. And one of the things that made me stop was I hate the internet. I hate social media. I find those to be very uncomfortable places to live. I don't know how to write about the present moment without occupying a fictional space that is very wrapped up in those, right? And this is a novel that I've heard does that in a very interesting way. And also, one thing that it's a novel about the present moment that I have heard does not easily fit into obvious kind of left-right paradigms. I was thinking about this. I tried reading Memory Piece by Stephanie Coe a few weeks ago. And it has this quality that a certain amount of, like, I will often read, this is going to sound kind of reactionary, and I don't mean for it to sound this way, but, like, I will every time I try to read acclaimed new fiction by a younger author, younger meaning, like, under 50 at this point, right? Someone who's roughly my peer. Every time I try to read acclaimed new fiction by people who are my peers, the character's internal monologue just reads like a Vox essay from 2020, right? It's like the characters are always thinking in great depth about racial and gender dynamics at all times, in ways that feel very dated and tedious. And in an underlying ideological way, I probably agree with for the most part, but that it's like we have this idea that fiction, because fiction allows us to inhabit perspectives, a certain amount of new fiction, particularly the stuff that's, like, kind of institutionally rewarded, ends up just being kind of like a one-dimensional recapitulation of the right ideas about race and gender in the moment, regardless of the year in which the characters are thinking or whatever, right? And I just find that, as a reader, I find that tedious, right? It's like broccoli fiction that we love for reasons that is beyond aesthetic merit. And I have heard that this is a novel that manages to think about the present moment in ways that transcend that. It also was rejected by the publisher as potentially offensive, and he self-published it, so it might be awful. I don't know. I've heard mixed things about whether or not it's deeply offensive and or good. But anyway, can't
shit,
promise.
A lot of buildup, dude.
A lot of buildup. A lot of buildup. So the pick is one last, actually, bit of prelude. Chris, have you seen the David Cronenberg film? Chris or Patrick, have either of you seen the David Cronenberg film Maps to the Stars?
No. I want to. That's on my list.
Well,
I want to watch that. I want to watch that before I watch Shrouds.
I've never even heard of that. I love Cronenberg.
It's not one of his more beloved movies, but it's interesting and watchable and fucked up and perverted and weird and dark. And the screenwriter for Maps to the Stars is named Bruce Wagner. And I am picking, I believe, his most recent novel, which is called The Marvel Universe Origin Stories.
Okay. The Marvel Universe Origin Stories by Bruce Wagner.
Right.
All right.
Not literally cool. About Marvel characters, if you're wondering. Nothing literally to do with... Obviously, the title is like a kind of, you know, play on the successful comic and film company, but that's a
right.
It's not actually about, like, Wolverine's childhood.
Too bad.
At least I don't think so. I haven't read it, so I can't say
right.
it for sure.
Right.
Excellent. So the next book we're reading is Bruce Wagner's The Marvel Universe Origin Stories. And we will be talking about that for the next episode. Thank you, gentlemen. And I hope you have a good rest of your day.
Peace out.